So if you would, thank you for the slides, and I hope I'll be able to scroll through those. If you would turn in your Bibles over to 1 Corinthians 12, that's where we'll begin today. We're going to start in the New Testament, but we're going to spend a lot of our time in the Old. Virtually all the rest of the message after this opening few remarks will be in the Old Testament. And this chapter is known for Paul's discussion about spiritual gifts. And I forgot one thing here. Let me get this started so I don't go past five. Okay. Again, the headline for this chapter is Spiritual Gifts and Their Use in Love. At least that's what is in my edition of the King James Version, New King James Version. So let's start in verse 4. Paul writes, "There are diversities of gifts, but the same Spirit. So God provides different gifts to his church using and through his Holy Spirit. Verse 5, there are differences of ministries, but the same Lord. There are diversities of activities, but it is the same Lord, the same God who works in all. But the manifestation of the Spirit is given to each one for the profit of all." So the purpose of giving gifts to his people by God is so that we can all be benefited. Through the gift that's given to each person, others in the congregation are able to grow and receive blessings of various types through those gifts. So what type of gifts does God get distribute through his Spirit? Well, Paul begins to explain that in verse 8. "For to one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, to another the word of knowledge through the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, to another gifts of healing by the same Spirit." Verse 10, "To another the working of miracles, to another prophecy, to another discerning of spirits, to another different kinds of tongues, and another the interpretation of tongues. But one and the same Spirit works through all these things, distributing to each one individually as he, God, wills." So Paul lists here some of the major gifts that God gives to his people in the church: wisdom, knowledge, faith, healing, miracles, prophecies, and so on. Now, if you've been in the church for any length of time, you've probably recognized that there are individuals who possess these types of gifts. And certainly it can be seen that some people have wisdom, for example. If you've had conversations with certain people or listened to folks as they spoke, you might think to yourself, well, that was a very wise observation that that individual made. And likewise, some individuals in God's church have a large measure of faith. And perhaps another has the proclivity for knowledge of their Bible. But on the other hand, the next three that are listed may seem to be in a little bit of short supply. He mentions healings and miracles and prophecy. Now, when I first came in the church, there seemed to be many instances of healing. You may have heard some older pastors say that in the 50s and 60s that there were quite a few instances of healing. And there's still healing today, but perhaps not quite so prevalent as what there may have been in the past. And the same might be said for miracles and prophecies. Many of us have probably experienced miraculous situations. I know I have. But has God given to individuals, anyone, the gift of miracles? Well, perhaps there's a time coming in the church that healing and miracles and prophecies may be more apparent. But today I want to spend the time looking at the life of an individual through whom God worked prophecies and miracles and healings. And in fact, the scriptures recorded more miracles that are worked through this person than perhaps any other individual besides Christ himself. However, despite his record of incredible miracles and healings, he's not quite as well known as his immediate predecessor. So we're going to delve today into the life of Elisha. Let me see if this is going to work. Am I doing the right one? No. How about that one? Let's see if it's on. Ah, that helps. There it goes. Okay. Wonder of the miracle of science. So to place some perspective around the life of Elisha, his story encompasses parts of 11 chapters in the books of 1 and 2 Kings. By contrast, the account of Elijah's ministry is given to us in just 6. And another difference, Elijah, who was known to perform spectacular miracles, performed 16 miracles, as you count them, versus Elisha, who has possibly 21 miracles recorded, depending on how you count miracles. Now, admittedly, the number of miracles is not necessarily a major measurement of a prophet's importance. As a background, we're going to cover today, the items we'll cover today take place in the land of Israel, and that's the northern kingdom, or the house of Israel. And you see that there. And that's the land in the northern part of that slide where the northern 10 tribes broke away and they became known as Israel or the house of Israel. And the section in the lower section is the house of Judah, which is a separate kingdom at that point. And within these episodes, we're going to see several cities mentioned, and you'll see them listed there, Samaria, which was the capital of the northern kingdom, and Dothan and Shunem are two of the cities that are mentioned in the scriptures we'll go through. So let's begin with the introduction of Elisha. And to do that, we have to go back to actually the time of Elijah, his predecessors, and his ministry. So you probably recall that in the years after David's and Solomon's reign, that Israel fell into a time of terrible sin against God. By the 1850s and 1860s BC, we find a wicked king ruling in the northern kingdom by the name of King Ahab. And his wife was the daughter of a pagan king, the notorious Jezebel. And together they introduced and they encouraged the people in the worship of pagan gods, gods especially that Jezebel had grown up with apparently. And it's at this point that God powerfully used the prophet Elijah to demonstrate for the people that the idols that they were turning to and the priests that were leading them were totally false. And in chapter 18 of 1 Kings, we won't turn there, God dramatically poured down fire, you probably recall, to consume a sacrifice that Elijah had made in order to powerfully show who the real God was. And immediately after that took place, Elijah was instructed to kill 450 of those false priests that were there watching it. And through these two actions, God intended to provide the opportunity for the nation to see who the real God was and once again turn back to him as they had been centuries earlier. But even though he had been used powerfully by God, when Queen Jezebel threatened his life after this episode, Elijah ran for his life. He took flight to Mount Sinai, where Moses received the Ten Commandments, and here he had a personal encounter with God himself. So let's pick up with this interaction with God at Mount Sinai, also called Mount Horeb. If you'd like, turn back to 1 Kings 19, and I'll start in verse 13. Elijah has just heard God speaking to him in a small voice. Verse 13. So it was, when Elijah heard it, that he wrapped his face in his mantle and went out and stood in the entrance of the cave, and suddenly a voice came to him and said, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" And he said, "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life." Then the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus." And now he's going to give him 3 tasks to perform. "And when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Syria. Also you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, king over Israel. And lastly, and Elijah, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place." So God begins to wind down Elijah's career here, and he gives him three anointings to accomplish. Two of them were kings, and lastly, his own successor, who will be Elisha. So we have here first Elisha mentioned in Scripture. So immediately, Elijah obeys God and sets out to fulfill his instructions. Verse 19, so he departed from there, and he found Elisha the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yokes of oxen before him, and he was with the 12th. Then Elisha passed by him and threw his mantle on him. Verse 20, and as he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, please let me kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow you. And he said to him, go back again, for what have I done to you? So Elisha turned back from him, took a yoke of oxen and slaughtered them and boiled their flesh using the oxen's equipment and gave it to the people, and they ate. Then he arose and followed Elijah and became his servant. So in this final act of his current life, Elisha kills two oxen, then makes a feast for his neighbors. And by this, he shows that he's now committed to the new life that he's been offered. He now becomes a prophet in training. Now, notice when his calling began that Elijah threw his mantle over him. And the use of the mantle would prove a very significant and symbolic act. And during the next 4 years, Elisha traveled with Elijah as his disciple. Now, we don't have a lot of information about Elisha's background. His name means God is salvation, but there's little agreement on the town that he was from or what his father or mother's background may have been. The accounts in his life as a prophet cover the rule of four kings: Jehoram, Jehu, Jehoahaz, and Jehoash, none of whom were righteous. In fact, none of the kings in the northern kingdom of Israel were righteous. They were just various degrees of evil. So let's pick up with this transition from Elijah to Elisha. And it takes place in 2 Kings chapter 2. And we're going to spend most of our time today in 2 Kings. Now I'm going to start reading from the New Living Translation here. Second Kings 2, verse 1, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, and Elijah and Elisha were traveling from Gilgal. And Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to Bethel. But Elisha said, surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you. So they went together down to Bethel. Now, even though he's been given a direct statement from Elijah, Elisha is determined to stay by the side of his master until the very instant that God takes him away. And as we'll see, as we proceed through this incident in his life, determination will prove to be one of Elijah's very personal characteristics. Verse 4, then Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to Jericho. But Elisha replied, as surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you. So they went together on to Jericho. Verse 6. Then Elisha said to Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has told me to go to the Jordan River. But again Elisha replied, as surely as the Lord lives and you yourself live, I will never leave you. So they went on together. Now 50 men of the group of the prophets also went, and they watched from a distance Elijah and Elisha as they stop by the Jordan River. Now, who are these men that are mentioned? Well, we're going to look into that in just a few moments. Verse 8, then Elijah folded his cloak together and struck the water with it. The water divided, and the two of them went across on dry ground. So this is a miracle that harkened back to when Moses and the tribes of Israel first crossed the Jordan River, as they entered the promised land for the first time. Verse 9, when they came to the other side, Elijah said to Elisha, tell me what I can do for you before I'm taken away. Now, it was Elijah making this offer, But certainly he could not have done so without God's inspiration and approval. And you'll recall another time when God offered to give a person whatever it was they desired. In 1 Kings 3, Solomon was asked by God what he desired. And Solomon humbly asked for the wisdom to rule over his people Israel. God was very pleased with that, and he provided wisdom along with quite a bit more. So what did Elisha request when he was offered this? Elisha replied, "Please let me have a double share of your spirit and become your successor." He's asking this to Elisha. So this is the gift that Elisha wants, a double portion of the spirit. So what he essentially is asking is a double measure of God's spirit. Of course, that's not something that Elisha could give. Only God would be able to grant such a request. So did God answer Elisha's request, his desire? Verse 10, Elijah says, "You have asked a difficult thing," Elijah replied. "If you see me when I am taken from you, then you will get your request. But if not, then you won't." So Elijah acknowledges that it's God who will make the decision to fulfill Elisha's desire. If it was a selfish request, God probably would not have answered. Now we read in James 4, verse 3, that when a person asks something from God in a wrong attitude, it will not be given to him. So how did God view Elisha's request here? We're going to find out in a moment. Verse 11, "As they were walking along and talking, suddenly a chariot of fire appeared, drawn by horses of fire. It drove between the two men, separating them, and Elijah was carried by a whirlwind into heaven." So this fiery transport descended down to the ground, and it headed to where the two men were standing, and they had to separate between themselves to keep from being run over. So Elijah stepped into the chariot, and both were sucked into a whirlwind, a small tornado. I'm a little ahead of myself. Elisha saw it and cried out, my father, I see the chariots and the charioteers of Israel." So apparently there were more than one that he was watching, and angels were driving these fiery horses. And as they disappeared from sight, Elisha tore his clothes in distress. So did God honor Elisha's desire? Well, he did. He was able to watch in astonishment as this spirit chariot picked him up and they all disappeared into the daylight sky. So that was the criteria that Elijah had given him for receiving a double portion of God's Spirit. Now, some people have read these scriptures and they've interpreted this description as meaning that God took Elijah into heaven to be with God himself. And further, they see this as a support for the doctrine that men go to heaven after they've died. But that's not what exactly is being shown here. Clearly, the heaven mentioned is the first heaven, the envelope of air that we have that surrounds the earth. It's not intended to depict the celestial heaven in which God dwells on his throne. The proof that Elijah did not go to the third heaven can also be found in 2 Chronicles 21:12. You can make a note of that if you'd like. 2 Chronicles 21:12. We won't turn there, but it describes a time quite a few years later when Elijah, who's clearly still alive, sends a letter of warning to another wicked king of Judah. Now let's continue with what's now the history of Israel's new prophet, Elisha. So we'll go to 2 Kings 2 and verse 13. "So Elisha picked up Elijah's cloak, which had fallen when he was taken up. Then Elisha returned to the bank of the Jordan River. He struck the water with Elijah's cloak and cried out, 'Where is the God, the Lord, the God of Elijah?' Then the river divided and Elisha went across." So immediately God hears and he answers Elisha, showing very clearly to the onlookers that are standing while watching this that he's now become Elijah's successor. Now the story continues with the men who were mentioned a few verses earlier, the sons of the prophet. They were standing some distance away from all this event, but they obviously saw what God had done. And in verse 15, they rush over to Elijah and bow to him out of respect, acknowledging that they recognize him as the man that they will now be working with and that God will be working with. But again, who are these other men? Well, here they're described as a group of men, and there may have been several groups such as this throughout Israel. And they may all be located in various different regions. They seem to be devoted to learning and serving God. The earliest mention goes back to even the time of Saul. And at least some dwelt together and some were married, as we'll see, and others may be living separately. But they all recognized Elijah and then now Elisha as their leader. But following this miraculous removal of Elijah, we find some very curious incident involving these men. Notice what they say in verse 15. Then they said to him, speaking to Elisha, "Look now, there are 50 strong men here with your servants. Please let them go and search for your master," meaning Elijah, "lest perhaps the Spirit of the Lord has taken him up and cast him upon some mountain or some valley." And he said, "You shall not send anyone." So they seem to have been worried that God wasn't really able to take care of Elijah. Maybe they feared that he fell out of the chariot when they were spirited away. But Elisha seems to recognize that their request is somewhat foolish, but he finally gives them permission to start a search. Verse 17, "But when they urged him till he was ashamed," and the word actually means confounded, "he said, 'Send them.' And therefore they sent 50 men, and they searched for 3 days, but they did not find him. And when they came back to him, for he had stayed in Jericho, he said to them, 'Did I not tell you not to go?'" Now immediately we find that God begins to perform miracles through Elisha that are made on behalf of the people. Verse 19 now. "Then the men of that city said to Elisha, 'Please notice, the situation of this city is very pleasant, as my Lord sees, but the water is bad and the ground is barren.'" And you may recall that decades earlier, Jericho, when the people first entered the land, had been cursed when God caused it to be overthrown by the Israelites. And later, the man who started rebuilding it was cursed with the death of his son. So a new generation is now trying to make it their home, and very possibly the water was still unfit because of that previous curse. But now we have a people that have come to God's representative, Elisha, and they're humbly asking that their source of water be healed so that they land and they can become productive. So were they right in asking this of the prophet? We find out in verse 20. He said, "Bring me a new bowl and put salt in it." So they brought it to him. And there he went out to the source of water and cast in the salt there and said, "Thus says the Lord, I have healed this water. From it there shall be no more death or barrenness." So the water remains healed to this day according to Elisha, which he spoke. So God uses salt throughout the Bible as a representative of preservation and purity. So here through Elisha, he now uses it to cleanse the water of the city, thus showing God's mercy for these citizens of the town. So later in that same chapter, we find another miracle, but it's a totally different type. And it's one that many detractors of the Bible use as proof of the cruelty of God. So we're going to go to 2 Kings 2:23. "Then he went up from there to Bethel, and as he was going up the road, some youths came up from the city and mocked him. And they said to him, 'Go up, you bald head, go up, you bald head.'" And obviously the words spoken are ones of derision. They're showing disrespect. But these are not innocent little children who really don't know who Elisha is. So are there chants just some kind of harmless fun? Well, let's read what happens to them. Verse 24. "So Elisha turned around and looked at them and pronounced a curse on them in the name of the Lord. And two female bears came out of the woods and mauled 20, 42 of these youths. So this isn't Elisha losing his temper. What he utters is in God's name, meaning by God's authority. And their taunts were probably related to the fact of how Elijah had been taken up by God into heaven. Now, perhaps they were sarcastically saying that they rejected the account that they had heard about that miracle. But don't make a mistake. These were not a group of small children. The Hebrew word covers teenagers up to people even in their early 20s. They were old enough to be away from their parents, and they seemed to be wandering by themselves in a large group, and that's rarely a good idea. And in the law, God clearly holds young people accountable for their actions. In Exodus 21:17, God records in the law, "And he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." And he also says in Leviticus 24:15, he says, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, whoever curses his God shall bear his sin." Well, they were in effect cursing God because they were cursing his representative. He was a representative of God. So God would certainly have been justified in exacting a death penalty on these individuals. But that's not necessarily what happened. The bears described were a Syrian brown bear. That's the type of bears that lived in that area. They're now extinct, but they were among the smallest of the brown bear subspecies. And the female, or the she-bear, as described here, was the smaller of the two. Now, furthermore, the word maul does not mean that the bears killed these 40-plus young people. It covers a large range of possible injuries. Most likely, they all suffered some kind of an injury that was sufficient for them to know that they had been taught a lesson based on what they had been saying. So in chapter 3, three kings, including the king of Israel and Judah, we move on now, decide to go to war against Moab. Now, we go into another story here. God uses Elijah to prophesy to them who will be victorious and what they are to do. I suggest you read that entire, the remainder of that entire chapter for yourself. But for the sake of time, I'm going to skip over that episode. That's in chapter 3. And we're going to go on to chapter 4 of 2 Kings. We're going to read about a widow. 2 Kings 4, verse 1. "A certain woman of the wives of the sons of the prophets cried out to Elisha, saying, 'Your servant, my husband, is dead, and you know that your servant feared the Lord, and the creditor is coming to take my two sons to be his slaves.'" So we have here the wife of one of those men that were in the sons of the prophets that we looked at just a few moments ago. And even though this man and his wife were following God, seems, and the man was probably being used in God's work to some degree, yet they were living in a very tough age, and they apparently had very little materially, and they were just scraping by. And what's worse, they somehow owed money to some kind of a lender. And by the law, he was able to take her two sons to be workers to pay off that outstanding debt. We would do well to recognize that God has certainly blessed us in this modern age as the modern descendants of Abraham, and we're not always going to have things so well as we have today. Like then, there may be some tough times coming for the very modern people of Israel. So this widow is in a terrible predicament, and she reaches out in faith to Elisha. Verse 2. "So Elisha said to her, 'What shall I do for you? Tell me, what do you have in the house?' And she said, 'Your maidservant has nothing in the house but a jar of oil.' Then he said, 'Go, borrow vessels from everywhere, from all of your neighbors, empty vessels. Do not gather just a few.'" Now, he could have miraculously provided her with money to pay off her bill, but that's not the way that God generally works. Instead, he expects the woman to take an action to help herself in this situation. And here she's told to go to all her neighbors that she can and borrow as many containers as they were willing to give. Verse 4, "And when you have come in, you shall shut the door behind you. you and your sons, and pour it into these vessels and set aside the full ones. He's talking about pouring the oil. So she's to take that little bit of oil she had in that small jar and empty it into these containers. So she went from him and shut the door behind her and with her sons, and brought the vessels to her, and she poured it out. Now it came to pass when the vessels were full that she said to her son, "Bring me another vessel." And he said to her, "That there is no other vessel." So the oil ceased. So as it happened, just as when Christ had multiplied the fish and the loaves centuries later, God here increases the small amount of oil that she starts with until all of these borrowed, empty jars are now totally full. Then she came and told the man of God, and he said, "Go, sell the oil and pay your debt, and you and your sons live on the rest." So the resulting oil was valuable enough that she could sell it, pay off her debts, and then use it to live on in the near future. Now we know that God expects his people to always care for and look out for the poor and widows and orphans. And through this miracle, he's used Elisha to serve a woman who qualified in all three categories. So as we read about Elisha and many of the miracles that he performed, they're not necessarily of a spectacular nature, although some are, but they're all often intended to help the common man, the common people of Israel, who were still trying to do the best that they could. Now we're going to move on to a similar incident, one that impacted another family of Israel. 2 Kings 4, verse 8. Now it happened one day that Elisha went to Shunem, where there was a notable woman. Now the Hebrew word for the woman can mean great, so she was probably a person of some importance. And she persuaded him to eat some food. So it was, as often as he passed by, he would turn in there to eat some food. Now, Shunem again was in the territory, as we saw, of Northern Kingdom. So this lady and her family generously have reached out, and they've showed hospitality to Elisha. Now, hospitality was a very important quality for the people of that day. And, of course, in the New Testament, God shows that he still wants people to show hospitality. The Apostle Paul admonishes God's people in Romans 12, verse 13, to give themselves to hospitality. You can make a note of that again, Romans 12, verse 13. Back to Elisha, verse 9. And she said to her husband, "Look now, I know that this is a holy man of God who passes by us regularly. Please, let us make a small upper room on the wall, and let us put a bed for him there, and a table, and a chair, and a lampstand. So it will be whenever he comes to us, he can turn in here." So going beyond just showing hospitality, she and her husband have now used their resources to construct a private room that Elisha could use whenever his journeys took him by. And Elisha certainly accepted the hospitality that was provided by this family. Verse 11, "And it happened one day that he came there, and he turned into the upper room to lay down there. And he said to Gehazi, his servant, 'Call this Shunammite woman.' And when he had called her, she stood before him. And he said to her, and he said to him, speaking to Gehazi now, 'Say now to her, look, you have been concerned for us with all this care. What can I do for you now? Do you want me to speak on your behalf to the king or the commander of the army?' She answered, 'I dwell among my own people.'" So it seems that these passages describe perhaps two conversations that take place, one with the woman herself and the other one with Gehazi, in which Elisha asks him his opinion about this. Verse 14, "What is then to be done for her?" And Gehazi answered, "Actually, she has no son, and her husband is old." So he said to her, to Gehazi, "Call her." And when he had called her, she stood in the doorway. Now about this, and he said, "About this time next year, you shall embrace a son." And she said, "No, my lord, man of God, do not lie to your maidservant." So she was incredulous about this statement. So Elisha had just given her a prophetic promise similar to what had been given by God to Sarah and Abraham. And she also likely was beyond childbearing age herself. So her reaction was similar to what Sarah had centuries earlier. Verse 17, but when the woman conceived and bore a son, when the appointed time had come, of which Elijah had told her. And the child grew, and now the story is going to jump ahead several years into the future. Now it happened one day that he went out to his father, this is the son, to the reapers. And he said to his father, my head, my head. So he said to his servant, carry him to his mother. And when he had been taken and brought to his mother, he sat on her knees till noon, and then he died. So tragically, this son that was the gift from God has died. But over the years, she's developed faith in God and confidence that Elisha is his servant. And she's not willing to give up without seeking God's help. Verse 22. Then she called to her husband and said, please send me one of the young men and one of the donkeys, that I may run to the man of God and come back. And he said, why are you going to him today? It's neither a new moon nor a Sabbath. And she said, it is well. So apparently her husband had not quite realized what the situation was, that his son had died. Verse 25. And so she departed and went to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So it was when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to his servant Gehazi, look, the Shunammite woman. Verse 28, so she said, did I ask a son of my Lord? Did I not say, do not deceive me? Verse 29, then he said to Gehazi, obviously he recognized at that point what the situation was. He said, get yourself ready and take my staff in your hand and be on your way. If you meet anyone, do not greet him. And if anyone greets you, do not answer him, but might lay my staff on the face of the child. And the mother of the child said, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, I will not leave you. So he rose and followed her. And it's interesting that the statement she gives here is the same thing that Elisha said when he was with Elijah years earlier. So now we're going to jump ahead to their arrival at the woman's house, verse 32. When Elisha came into the house, there was the child lying on his bed. He went in, therefore, shut the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. And he went up and lay on the child, and put his mouth on his mouth, his eyes on his eyes, and his hands on his hands, and he stretched himself out on the child. And the flesh of the child became warm. Then he returned and walked back and forth in the house, and he went up again and stretched himself out on him. And the child sneezed seven times, and the child opened his eyes. And he called Gehazi and said, call this Shunammite woman. So he called her, and when she came in, he said, pick up your son. So she went in, fell at his feet, bowed to the ground, and she picked up her son and went out. So here we do have a very great miracle, a young boy who's been raised from the dead. And years later, we'll also see that Christ raised one from the dead, Lazarus in particular. And as we go through some of these episodes that's recorded in Elisha's ministry, we also see some parallels to the life of Elijah, his mentor. Elijah also, in one case, developed a friendship with a woman in the land whose son also almost died. And as God intervened in the prayer of Elijah on that occasion, he did so here with Elisha in almost the exact same manner. And in both cases, the prophets were directed to become very personally involved in the method that God was using to restore those sons back to life. Now, I mentioned again that many of Elisha's miracles were not very spectacular. God didn't bring huge number of Israelites to repentance, but he did intervene powerfully in the life of many average citizens who may have displayed obedience and faith in God. So in this story of the Shunammite son, we see she put her trust in God, and immediately God answered her prayer and took action. God rewarded her for her single-minded faith that she had displayed. Now, even though, again, this last miracle was not used by God to display his glorious power to the nation, It did bring about a very life-changing event in the life of this family. Now we're going to go to another miracle that seems relatively unimportant, except to one individual. And I'm not covering these necessarily in order, but go forward to chapter 6. And again, Elisha is interacting with the sons of the prophets. 2 Kings 6, verse 1, "And the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, 'See now, the place where we dwell with you is too small.'" So apparently, Elisha may have been spending some time staying with these devoted men, and maybe he was involved with teaching them during those times. But they concluded that they needed a larger building to live in for the activities that they were taking part of, and maybe some of it might have been something like a bunkhouse. Verse 2, "Please let us go to the Jordan, and let every man take a beam from there, and let us make a place there a place where we may dwell." So he answered, "Go." Then one said, "Please consent to go with your servants." And he answered, "I will go." So they went with them, and when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was cutting down a tree, the iron axe head fell into the water. And he cried out and said, "Alas, master, for it was borrowed. So this man had to borrow an axe in order to take part in this work party that he was with. But as he was felling trees near the water, the metal head flew off of the handle. Now, no one was injured, but it landed in the water. And either the water was too deep at that spot, or perhaps the flow of the water was too strong. But either way, he was faced with the task of replacing it, or perhaps compensating the owner of the axe. Now, you might wonder, why was he so upset? Maybe he was just poor, and he couldn't afford to buy one. Maybe axes were relatively hard to find at that time. But either way, he turns to Elisha for help. But actually, he was appealing to God for help. Elisha had no more ability to retrieve the axe than the worker did. So did Elisha think this was an unworthy action for God's attention? Well, we see that's not the case. Verse 6, "So the man of God said, 'Where did it fall?' And he showed him the place. So he cut off a stick and threw it in there, and he made the iron float. Therefore, he said, 'Pick it up for yourself.' So he reached out his hand, and he took it." So have you ever encountered a situation that was important to you, but perhaps it was very small in the scheme of things? Others might have advised you to just forget about it. Just learn a lesson and move on. Now, Elisha could have given this man the same kind of wisdom. Maybe perhaps inspect your equipment before you use it. Or maybe don't borrow something if you don't have the means to replace it. But Elisha didn't say any of those things. Instead, he just took action. He moved him to do something simple, throw a stick in the water where the axe had landed, and he retrieved it. So we might ask ourselves, is there anything too small, too trivial, to ask God's help with? Notice a couple of scriptures that apply here. God asked this question in Jeremiah 32, verse 27. God says, "Behold, I am the Lord, the God of all flesh. Is there anything too hard for me?" Well, certainly we see the answer is no. God can do anything, and anything that we might ask. So how should we approach a situation like this one, this situation that the son of the prophet had? Well, Paul also tells us something about that in Philippians 4, 6. Philippians 4, 6, he says, "Be anxious for nothing, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God." So certainly God included in this seemingly very insignificant situation to show us that there's no problem that's too small for God. Now, by the same token, this was a problem that the man himself could not reasonably handle. So if he had been able to retrieve the axe, he certainly would have been expected to do so. Now, we have only enough time to cover one more episode in the life of Elisha. But there are at least three miracles that will take place in the course of this next story. And it follows immediately after the miracle of this axe head. Now, it begins with Israel's neighbor, Syria, and it's referred in these passages as Aram, which is preparing to invade and attack Israel. And we start by listening in on some of the behind-the-scenes discussion that will take place between the king and his officers. 2 Kings 6, verse 8. And I'm going to read this section in the New Living Translation. When the king of Aram was at war with Israel, he would confer with his officers and say, "We will mobilize our forces at such and such a place." The king is known, this king is known in secular history as Ben-Hadad II. And he's developing a strategy and the details of the war that he intends to attack Israel with. He's planning to set up troop concentrations before launching his battles. Now, naturally, this would be very top secret information. It shouldn't be revealed outside of his small circle of generals and other officers. Verse 9, "But immediately Elisha, the man of God, would warn the king of Israel, 'Do not go near that place, for the Arameans are planning to mobilize their troops there.' So the king of Israel would send word to the place indicated by the man of God. Time and again, Elisha warned the king so that he would be on the alert." Now, with this secret information that's provided by God to Elisha, and then it's forwarded to Israel's kings, the forces of Israel were able to avoid some direct confrontations and battles. You might say that this is a kind of a code breaking that's going on here. And it was beginning to confound the Syrian king. His war initiatives are not working out as he expected. Verse 11, "The king of Aram became very upset over this. He called his officers together and demanded, 'Which of you is the traitor? Who has been informing the king of Israel of my plans?' So he concluded that there must have been a spy among his senior officers. How else could Israel keep thwarting his various battle plans?" Verse 12, "It's not us, my lord the king," one of the officers replied. "Elisha, the prophet in Israel, tells the king of Israel even the words you speak in the privacy of your bedroom." So how did this officer come to know that Elisha was the one that was intercepting the details of his strategy? Well, perhaps God gave him insight so the rest of God's plan could go forward. So whether that's what happened or not, the king accepted the advice of this man and he decided to eliminate Elisha. Verse 13, he says, "Go and find out where he is," the king commanded, "so I can send troops and seize him." And the report came back, "Elisha is at Dothan." So one night, the king of Aram sent a great army with many chariots and horses to surround the city. When the servant of the man of God got up early the next morning and went outside, there were troops, horses, and chariots everywhere. "Oh, sir, what will we do now?" the young man cried to Elisha. So he's certain that there's a disaster about to take place and possibly death. And of all the miracles that he may have witnessed at the hand of Elisha, he didn't seem to have developed any faith. Verse 16, "Don't be afraid," Elisha told him. "There are more on our side than on theirs." So what did Elijah mean by that, Elisha? All that he could see were these hordes of soldiers, cavalry, and the chariots, all facing Elisha's house. Elisha prayed, "O Lord, open his mind and let him see." The Lord opened the young man's eyes, and when he looked up, he saw the hillside around Elisha was filled with horses and chariots of fire. So he was now able to see some of God's spirit armies, all of them apparently giving off flames of fire. And you may recall that Christ himself told his disciples that at any time he was needed, God could have sent him a legion of angels. And here Elisha and his servants see what probably was a very small number of those armies of heaven. Now, perhaps God has on many occasions provided us with heavenly protection that we didn't see like this servant. Verse 18, As the Aramean army advanced towards him, Elisha prayed, O Lord, please make them blind. So the Lord struck them with blindness, as Elisha had asked. So here's the third miracle that God produced in support of Elisha and Israel. This entire advancing army suddenly becomes blind, at least temporarily. And the intent of the Syrian army and those troops had been to kill or at least to capture Elisha. And then they were intended to conquer the little nation of Israel. So does God intend to have his spirit army destroy the Syrian army at that point? Verse 19, Elisha said and went out and told them, the soldiers that have become blind, you have come the wrong way. This isn't the right city. Follow me and I will take you to the man you are looking for. But instead he led them to the city of Samaria. Again, Samaria was the capital of Israel. They didn't really have much choice. I'm sure that Elisha sounded very friendly. Now, from what I can find, Dothan was about 11 or 12 miles away from that capital. So the march probably took several hours. They must have wondered what would happen to them when they arrived at the final destination that Elisha was leading them to. Verse 20, as soon as they had entered Samaria, Elisha prayed to the Lord, now open their eyes and let them see. So the Lord opened their eyes, and they discovered that they were in the middle of Samaria. When the king of Israel saw them, he shouted to Elijah, my father, should I kill them? Should I kill them? And naturally, the king jumped to the conclusion that God must have led them there so they could all be wiped out. But that's not necessarily the way God operates. He tells us in Romans 12, verse 20, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him a drink, for in so doing you will heap coals of fire on his head. That was written by Paul, but the original statement was made by Solomon in Proverbs 25, verses 21 and 22. The king, if he had read those scriptures written by Solomon, as he was commanded to, he should have known them. So what instead did God inspire Elisha to say? Verse 22, of course not, Elijah replied. Do we kill prisoners of war? Give them some food and drink and send them home again to their master. So the king made a great feast for them and sent them home to their master. After that, the Aramean raiders stayed away from the land of Israel. So here is perhaps the most amazing of the miracles that God worked through Elisha. And it impacted not only Israel, but the army of their very warlike neighbor. Now that's all the episodes that I have time to cover today, but over these first few chapters of 2 Kings, there's quite a few other stories and miracles that we didn't discuss, so I encourage you to read those in the coming few days. So we've looked briefly at 6 episodes containing miracles that God accomplished in the life of Elisha. So what lessons can we take away from this man and from the miracles and the prophecies that God accomplished through him? Well, first, some commentators have drawn a parallel between the ministries of Elijah, followed by Elisha, with that of John the Baptist and Jesus Christ himself. Elijah, similar to John the Baptist, spent most of his life away from the crowds, frugally living off the land. When they both came out of seclusion, they had powerful messages proclaiming who God is. Both at one time were fed by ravens. Now Elisha, who followed Elijah, spent more of his time with the Israelite people, similar to how Christ spent much of his ministry. And both performed a series of miracles, some life-giving and others not so spectacular. So the purpose of all those miracles was in part to declare how great God and glorious God is, and they caused, and through those miracles, he caused many to turn to God. Now second, he healed the water of a city using salt, which is representative of the spiritual healing that God can provide to any that come to him. In the story of the youth and the bears, we see that God shows that respect and honor is required of his servants. Now, when a woman, having lost her husband, faced the loss of her children too, God demonstrated his concern for widows who put their faith in him. In the story of the Shunammite woman, we see that God rewarded a family who dealt kindly with his servants. He went on then on to predict the unexpected gift of a son, and then he miraculously raised that son when he had died. We saw that God worked a miracle through Elisha, raising an axe head lost in a river, showing that nothing is too menial to seek God's help with. And when the Syrians planned to attack Israel, God used Elisha to show that he had unseen forces that are deployed to protect God's people. And he went on to use him in a remarkable display of mercy involving this entire foreign army. So the accounts that we've read of today are just a portion again of the miracles and the prophecies that God worked through his dedicated servant. And all of those prophecies that he inspired Elisha to utter and the supernatural events that he worked through Elisha, we find clear evidence that God loves the people of Israel. And indeed, we know he loves all of mankind. Among the accounts that we didn't read, that you'll find that as he laid on his deathbed, God even pronounced a blessing for Israel through Elisha's deathbed. And finally, even years later after Elisha had died, God miraculously caused a man to be raised up from the dead by simply coming into contact with Elisha's bones. So again, I would recommend that you take the time this week to read through some of these chapters about Elisha. They're in 2 Kings. I think you'll find them both inspiring and quite remarkable.